For the week of February 22nd, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 270, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm, you know, Sperling, let's just reboot this show. Let's start it all over again. Let's, I don't know, should we get new hosts? Should we get a new name? What should we do?
Well, I'm not going to vote for a new host, obviously.
That would be dumb, wouldn't it? Actually, you know, last week you said, reboot. I think that just came up for the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man. Isn't that the first time Hollywood used reboot? And I, of course, with very little knowledge, immediately said, that's not true.
Well, which, by the way, again, is kind of your forte, with very little knowledge standing up and proclaiming something adamantly.
Thank you very much. The less you know, the more loudly you speak. Hence Fox News. Anyway, so you said that, and then I thought, well, I don't actually know that. I mean, it doesn't sound right, but let's look into it. And I couldn't get anybody from the library to nail me down the earliest citation, but the earliest citation I could find for somebody using the word reboot to mean relaunch a film franchise, start over from scratch, is actually back from 2009. It was from Video Hound, which is sort of a movie reference guide that was well known for a while. And they had a website and a blog post. And in one blog post, this guy talked about 25 franchises that needed rebooting. And it used reboot in quotes, which would indicate that it wasn't really widely used yet. And so he wasn't sure if people understood what he was saying. So he said, we need to reboot them. And of course, the phrase comes from computers. But that was back in 2009. So it's clear that rebooting was being used before they relaunched Spider-Man in 2012. So that's clearly not the case. But it is interesting that it's not that long ago. It's only about, you know, that was only 5-6 years ago. So there's probably an earlier citation. We'll have to keep looking. But, you know, I guess reboot is actually a pretty recent phrase.
As I suggested.
So if we're not going to reboot the show, what are we going to talk about?
Well, yeah, I guess maybe, you know, instead of entomology, we should probably talk about the entertainment news from this past week, because a lot happened. On this week's show, we're going to be joined by Ann Thompson, who attended last night's Academy Award festivities. Of course, Ann is the editor of Thompson on Hollywood, IndieWire's editor-at-large, and host of the Screen Talk podcast with Eric Cohn. She'll be here to give us her thoughts on this year's Oscar winners and the ceremony itself. Now, stick around afterwards to hear a special musical performance by Lady Gaga. Now, speaking of music, Broadway seems to be awash in new musicals. We'll tell you what they are and which ones to look out for. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire who didn't introduce himself at the head of the show, Michael Giltz, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're talking about box office from around the world, not just North America. We pull our information from Rentrack. We link to their site in our show notes. We also get info from Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. Anywhere we can track down info about worldwide box office, we include it here. And the number one movie around the world, despite falling 75% in North America, people are tired of spanking, is 50 Shades of Grey.
And you were right. You were right. You said it would drop like a rock. What you didn't say is that it would drop like a rock off of a cliff, which well, apparently it did.
Well, it's doing better overseas. It held a little better, but it was front-loaded. It was Valentine's Day. It was a high-interest movie. It's not having great lays because the audience scores weren't really strong. People had fun in it, but I don't think they wanted to see it 2, 3, 4, or 5 times. But it's made $91 million over the weekend. It's past the $400 million mark. It will almost certainly hit $500 million. And for a movie that cost $40 million to make, it's all gravy. At number two around the world is Kingsman, The Secret Service. That's, of course, the film directed by Matthew Vaughn, the director of Kick-Ass and, of course, X-Men First Class. It is doing quite well, another $50 million worldwide. It's at $150 million and counting. It looks like it could be doing well enough to have a sequel. We'll have to see where it ends up, but it costs $80 million to make, but it's doing pretty well. It dropped 50% in North America, but the reviews are much better and the audience reviews are much better, so we'll have to see where it ends up. At number three is SpongeBob SquarePants 2. I'm not sure why it took so long to do a sequel, but they did. It's at $200 million worldwide.
Sponges are notoriously difficult to work with.
And it grossed $37 million over the weekend. Right below that at $33 million is Dragon Blade. This is a Chinese drama. It stars Jackie Chan and John Cusack and Adrian Brody. They paid big bucks to pull in American stars for their movie.
And also because John Cusack and Adrian Brody are fluent Mandarin speakers.
I'm not sure. I'm sure they're great at it. But this is one of many films that have been playing big in China because it is Chinese New Year. It is New Year's in China, I should say, to show a little more respect for other countries. But there are a lot of movies that opened up or are playing big this weekend. This is one of them. It's Dragon Blade. It was shot in IMAX and IMAX 3D. I shouldn't say it was shot in IMAX, but it's being shown in IMAX and 3D. So it's a big ticket movie. It's hit $50 million so far. Right below that worldwide is American Sniper. That grossed $30 million. That's at $430 million worldwide. And then a string of other Chinese films. From Vegas to Macau 2 is a Chinese comedy that I say drama. I think it's a comedy. I think it's a comedy starring Chow Yun-fat. Very bad reviews, but it's doing well at the box office. Right below that is
Snow Girl
and the Dark Crystal. This is another Chinese, it's sort of a fantasy epic. It's based on a famous anti-hero, I'm not sure what to compare him to in North America, known as Zhang Kui. And I think if you saw a picture of Zhang Kui, you'd recognize him because the illustration of Zhang Kui appears in front of lots of homes and businesses. And if you've seen any Chinese film, you've probably seen that image. He's just a very famous folk hero, and this is a movie telling one of his tales or a new spin on one of his classic tales. Right below that is Wolf Totem. This is kind of fascinating. Talk about China ready to do business with anyone. This is a French-Chinese co-production. It grossed $14 million over the weekend, and it's at $27 million and counting. It's based on a semi-autobiographical novel that was published anonymously because it's about a writer going to the countryside during the Cultural Revolution in 1969. He goes there to educate farmers, and instead, of course, they educate him. He learns about their wonderful relationship to wolves and how the indifferent bureaucracy is going to mess this up somehow, and so he fights for the rights of the shepherds and the wolves. And it was directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud.
What?
Why is that a big deal? Because he made 7 Years in Tibet, a film about China invading Tibet, a film banned in China, but they wanted to make this movie. They didn't know how to deal with wolves, frankly. They were worried. They didn't have the expertise to make a movie with humans and wolves interacting. They reached out to Peter Jackson. Those talks went nowhere. And they finally reached out to Jean-Jacques Annaud. He agreed to make the movie. They spent years raising wolves from pups so that they would be comfortable around humans and they could make the film. So this took like years to make this movie. Take that, Boyhood. And they made a movie with him. It's a $40 million co-production. It's going to open in France soon. And that's China where they say, I guess, you know, money speaks louder than politics.
Well, and of course, Twilight said, look, I don't know what's so special about this. We did this years ago.
That's right. There are a couple other, we should just jump to them. Where Are We Going, Dad 2 is another movie spun off from a TV show where fathers and their kids go off to the countryside to explore China. This is a new feature film spun off from that TV series.
And that's all the way down at number 12.
That's
so,
right.
And so Triumph, we're kind of jumping. Yeah.
That's right. And Triumph in the Skies is a spinoff from a big TV series. It's more of a Hong Kong than Chinese movie, if that distinction still holds anymore. It grossed $10 million over the weekend. The TV series started in 2003. They did another season in 2013, and they finally spun it off into a feature film. It's sort of a, I think it's based on Cathay Pacific, and it's just a glamorous film about pilots and stewardesses back in the day as they jaunt around the world. I think it's a period piece, but I'm not sure about that. So those are all the crush of films that opened up in China. Oh, there's one more, Emperor Holidays, which is a family comedy. So you can imagine, like, you went to the box office this weekend in China, there were like 10 new movies waiting for you, because I guess everybody celebrates New Year's and then they go out to the movies.
Yeah, well, kind of like you know, the holiday week here between Christmas and New Year's. I guess, well, not only here in North America, but the rest of the world, or not. I'm kind of painting myself into a corner here because it's really, Western Europe and, the Christian world. I don't know what you'd say, but,
I'm just gonna let you keep talking.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
the holiday season,
the holiday
season about it.
In the Roman calendar. I don't know.
There are other holidays other than, you know, Christmas. There's Hanukkah. There's, you know, all sorts of holidays taking place towards the end of the year. Don't worry about it. The holiday season is a big time for movies in North America and lots of parts of the world.
Okay.
How's that?
That sounds good to me. And
we got down to around to 9, 10, 11, 12. If you go down a little bit, there are two movies that did very well opening up in North America. They are McFarland USA, which is a pretty low-budget Disney film starring Kevin Costner about, are they Hispanic or Latino? I think they're Latino kids who become track stars. It's a period thing, a classic Disney family sports film, and it opened to $11 million. And right around there is Duff, The Duff, which is a high school comedy, which also did quite well. These are modestly budgeted movies. They both opened to $11 million, and they both look like they could have legs and spin out to be a pretty profitable films. In contrast is Hot Tub Time Machine 2, a movie nobody was waiting for, but they made it anyway. And that grossed $5 million over its opening weekend. The first one made all its money on DVD and video on demand. Maybe they're hoping for the same for the sequel.
Well, I was at an industry event over the past week, and somebody from Disney was there, and to thank this person, they said, hey, you know, and McFarland USA opens this week, and so everybody should go see that. It stars Kevin Costner playing Kevin Costner. Like, I thought, oh, okay. Yeah, that's actually a very good description of what that movie probably is.
Well, you know, 50 Shades of Grey is the number one movie around the world. It's a huge success. And of course, we all heard about the director and the writer who had an unusual amount of input on the film, butting heads, and the director isn't coming back. Turns out the writer, E.L. James, wants even more control over the next sequel. She wants to write the script. She didn't write it the first time, and she worked with the writer, but then she was unhappy when the studio demanded that the sex be toned down, and she and the writer parted ways a little unhappily. That's what some reports say. And now she wants to actually write the script for the two sequels, or at least the first one. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah, I think they may let her. I don't know whether they're going to let her do this or not.
Better write a script. Who cares? And then you have someone else rewrite it or do something entirely different.
Well, apparently she has approval over any rewrite.
Well, you know, she doesn't have the right to make the script or she wouldn't be asking or fighting for it. So we'll see what happens. But anyway, the movie made tons of money. Her input was controlling. And therefore, you might, if you're the studio, say, you know what? It made money. She wants it. Well, you know, we'll fight a little bit, but we'll let her make the movie she wants. Next, maybe she'll direct the third one.
You know, what I loved was this story about 50 Shades of Grey. First of all, playing at a drive-in. Okay. Which is already a little like eyebrow raising. Okay.
Why? Drive-ins are often, you know, in their heyday, weren't they the trashy B-movie world?
I guess so. Yes, you're right. No, I guess also because it's the middle of winter in the Northern Hemisphere. So lots of
there
drive-ins.
There aren't a lot of drive-ins open right now. That's true.
Yeah. So lots of drive-ins are closed, but it's playing here in California. And there's two screens or a couple of screens at this particular drive-in. One is showing 50 Shades of Grey, and right across the parking lot there, you got the old SpongeBob 2 playing, so that, you know, if the kiddies turn around, they're going to get an eyeful.
Well, that's, you know, that happens a lot at drive-ins. You will have PG on one side and R on the other. So I guess that's nothing new. But you know why young people, not kids, but, you know, teenagers and young adults, they go to drive-ins to make out. So why not 50 Shades of Grey?
Yeah, nobody's watching any of the movies anyway.
That's right. But they were watching the Academy Awards, though not as much as last year.
So, Michael, you must be referring to the ratings of this year's Grammys. What are the early numbers in?
They are. They're like down 10 or 14%, as most other award shows have been this year. I'm imagining more people are watching it on their DVR or the next morning or, you know, later that night like I did. I ran through the commercials and just watched the show starting at like 10:30 or 11. So sometimes that doesn't get reflected in the overnights. But it's still going to be one of the biggest shows of the year.
And if you started at 10:30 or 11, that means you should still be watching them.
Well, yes, but luckily we got to be at home. I got to eat popcorn. I got to relax. I could pause. I wasn't trapped in the theater like Ann Thompson, was I?
No. And as a matter of fact, why don't we talk to Ann Thompson? Of course, as we mentioned at the head of the show, Ann Thompson is from Thompson on Hollywood, the editor there, also the editor at large over at IndieWire, and the host of Screen Talk, a podcast that she hosts with Eric Cohn. And I guess that takes over from Oscar Talk. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. It's a ritual I would not want to miss.
Now, here's the question that I have. Have you slept at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I did sit inside the house at the Oscars, which is always so much fun, even when you realize that it's a relatively weak show for those at home. But there's just so much energy on the red carpet and in the room. And this year, it was such an exciting race because there really were some unknowns. Most of the time, we go in there with a pretty good idea of what's going to happen. And just to see the Selma performance of Glory, or to see Lady Gaga in all her glory, was great fun.
Yeah, we should point out Lady Gaga will be here later to sing a special performance. I've learned actually by watching the Oscars that if you say Lady Gaga's going to be on the entire time, your ratings apparently are better.
They were lucky to have her. Very lucky. She was the best thing on the whole show.
So, Anne, what was the disconnect? You were in the place watching the show, and then afterwards you come out and you find out what people thought of the show. What was the disconnect between how you guys experienced it in the theater and the way it played for people at home, if any?
Well, I think everybody had the sense that Neil Patrick Harris was a bit tentative. And I think that the signature moment for me that sort of encapsulated the whole thing, that when he came out in his skivvies, right, and he's running around, which was funny, and then he's walking off the stage and he touches his butt and his nipples, and the people who are presenting are like reacting to it, but the people at home didn't see that moment. And I just think they missed a lot of edgier, funnier stuff. They played it safe.
Oh, you think that was a choice rather than poor direction? Because I felt there were a
Either
few things
one,
that were missed.
But I think the writing was really the weakest because he just gave so many lines that fell flat, even in the room. In other words, the show itself, the winners themselves, the people who were actually, and they were so worried about length. I mean, my God, poor Polakowski at the beginning of the show doesn't have time to do his thing.
I was curious with them. Yeah, well, and he was the filmmaker who won the Best Foreign Language Feature for Ida from Poland.
Ida.
I know I've been mispronouncing that now for months. I will probably
well,
go on mispronouncing.
I couldn't believe that Neil Patrick Harris mispronounced David Oyelowo. Now, I grant that it took me a really long time to learn how to say that, but that's my job, and that certainly was his job.
Yeah, and then he mispronounced Chiwetel Ejiofor, but then he kind of later on at the end of the show made up for it by saying, no, I did that so that everybody else in the world would know how to pronounce it properly.
Yeah, but he didn't admit that he also mauled, you know, David Oyelowo, which I thought was funny.
It's an easy show to make fun of. It's an easy show to criticize, but it's also an easy show that could be better, don't you think?
We say this every year, you know. I actually thought they did very well last year. I think Ellen marked a high point. For example, I don't think Neil Patrick Harris worked the room as effectively. His bit with Steve Carell was not good. And, you know, I just don't think it had the same energy that Ellen brought to it.
Yeah, I guess, you know, and we're talking mostly about the ceremony itself and the telecast. But you mentioned earlier that, you know, it could have had a little bit more drama, no pun intended, because there was no real front runner this year between Boyhood and Birdman. They looked like it was going to be either one of those films for Best Picture, but you didn't know who was really going to win and whether Best Director would go to Richard Linklater.
Right.
And me.
And we didn't know who was going to win necessarily Best Actor. I mean, it turns out that the guilds were predictive. It turns out that, yes, Birdman did have the swell of support that it needed to go all the way. But we really, it was hard to read the signs this year. And it turns out that if you win SAG, you know, for another year, that stat is holding for 10 years. 100% of the winners have gone on to win the Oscar. And so Eddie Redmayne did do that.
And let me ask you this, because I couldn't believe, I mean, look, 12, 13 years ago, we were awarding, as if I'm part of the Academy. The Academy was awarding the Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, which was, you know, questionable whether that was the best movie that year. But it was an amazing feat that Peter Jackson and his team were able to complete three movies of Lord of the Rings. So they were kind of awarding the whole series. And that feat. Yet at the same time, in that very moment, Richard Linklater began making Boyhood, and that feat of doing a film over 12 years that actually was decent seems to have just kind of, yeah, it's a feat, but whatever.
No, I think it was a close race, and I think Patricia Arquette was always going to win supporting actor. To tell you the truth, I thought Whiplash would be the movie that was settling, you know, another small-scale indie You know, that one would be settling for just supporting actor for J.K. Simmons. And it ended up winning two more. And at the beginning of the night, when it took editing, as it did on Saturday at the Spirits, I realized that Boyhood wasn't going to win Best Picture, you know. So that's just the way it fell out.
So I don't think we said Birdman won Best Picture, Best Director for Iñárritu, sorry, I'm mispronouncing names today.
They're hard.
and also Best Script. That surprised me.
That was a shocker, too. I thought that would go to Budapest, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, everybody and their mother gets up and thanks Wes Anderson, even people who weren't in his movie, practically.
And then he goes, but I was surprised by that. That shows you how strong Birdman really was.
Or do you think it was a vote split?
Well, it's always
a vote split.
Well, there were several races had more like three major contenders in the race. That included editing, that included sound mixing, and it included director, picture, and actor. They had multiple, maybe director was just two, really, but that's how you have surprises like that.
It's a shame that a night of so many surprises, you sort of watch the show and we're a little bored. I always feel you watch the Oscars and all you end up talking about are the musical numbers and this and that. You don't talk about the movies in the sense of they didn't show you enough clips from the big movies to get you excited about the films. These aren't films most people have seen. And yet they do three movies here for Best Picture and then three more than two. They seem to throw them out like sort of, yeah, okay, here's a couple movies. These are up for Best Picture. Here they are.
Yeah,
okay, move on.
It definitely, somebody made a crack on, you know, a Whiplash joke that the show dragged and rushed, you know, and it did both. And I agree with that. There was this sense that they were just rushing through and then missing fabulous moments. And then they were dragging too. And what was Jennifer Hudson doing? I didn't understand that at all.
In Memoriam was terrible. Again, why do a song after In Memoriam? We know the person singing says, I want to be the center of attention.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
But I agree.
Then don't have them. I mean, it was fine. And why not show clips, for God's sakes? These are movie stars. Why aren't we seeing Mickey Rooney? Why aren't we ending with Betty Bacall saying, put your lips together? And, you know, come on. It's why are you ignoring the reason we're celebrating them? It just doesn't make any sense.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is really what I realized last night is as I was watching, I thought, you know what? The best part of the show is the people giving speeches, especially because...
Which almost never happens.
I know. And
they also took the advantage, I mean, which I found very dramatic, of and I predicted accurately that the political theme would be the thing everybody reported on, but they took what they cared about. I mean, Patricia Arquette was very moving. I was amused and delighted up in the balcony, in the mezzanine, you know, to see all these men in their penguin suits applauding for Patricia Arquette and her feminist rant. I loved it.
It felt more like the DNC than the Academy Awards.
Even Iñárritu at the end was going for his homeland. I mean, this is a global broadcast, and he was aware that his country was... That's what's great about it, is when Mexico is cheering for Best Picture.
I love the fact that he said, uh-oh, you know, the NSA, somebody's immigration, they're going to... The two Mexicans in a row, and he was referring to Carlos Cuarón, who he thanked. Oh, sorry, Alfonso Cuarón.
Well, his amigos are the ones who keep his ego in check, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he says the ego loves competition. I loved all of that.
Well, and I was very glad that he brought Michael Keaton up on stage.
Yes.
And then said, look, I've already had a chance to talk three times already. Let's let Michael Keaton speak because...
Well, I don't think he had any speeches left.
Well, that's
I
true.
He already used them up.
But speaking of things that are left... You mentioned that SAG has predicted 10 years in a row. So Eddie Redmayne won SAG for The Theory of Everything, playing Stephen Hawking. He wins again last night. That award seems to either be kind of a knighthood for like a lifetime achievement or a launching pad, a kind of anointing a new movie star. Last night they chose to do the latter, to anoint Eddie Redmayne as a new star to watch. And yet Michael Keaton gave the performance of his life. I don't know that he will ever have a performance that can outmatch that.
I know. And I really thought they would give it to him. And they obviously spread the wealth a bit. The thing about Redmayne is that he worked the room so effectively. He charmed everyone. Everyone fell in love with him. That was one thing that I realized in the house was that they were just cheering for him.
Yes, I did notice that.
Cheering for him. And, each role had its own level of difficulty. Let's put it that way. And they've always gone for the, twisted, afflicted Daniel Day-Lewis kind of performance. And they did it here. I mean, they really marveled at what he pulled off on playing this ALS victim, Stephen Hawking.
Well, and let me ask this. You talk about cheering in the room, but the one moment where I felt last night watching it at home, where it kind of translated from what was happening in the room to across the living room to me was the performance of Glory, which
was... No question, because there was that chorus. That sent chills up my spine in the room. It was the most beautiful thing. It was so powerful. And everyone was moved.
So wait, you're saying that actually having live music and musicians there in the room...
Remember last year?
Makes
a
difference.
Remember what they did? I think they learned their lesson.
No, they were down the street. The orchestra...
Yeah, most of the time. The orchestra was across the street.
Oh, they did that again?
Yes. And they
wondering about that because there was one number. Which was the number where they were doing like backup singers who weren't there?
Oh, yeah. A couple of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, they were in the house, so that made an enormous difference.
And at the end, you saw Chris Pine was in tears, David Oyelowo was in tears, everybody was in tears, and I thought, okay, well, I guess it translated there as well, not only on television.
Exactly.
So what was your favorite speech, Anne? My pick would be Common and John Legend for actually winning for that song.
They were good. I'm going to pick Patricia Arquette, actually. And I was, but I thought Laura Poitras was very strong as well. And Ina Ritu, too. I mean, everybody, the when he finally mentions Mexico, that was heartfelt to me.
Mm-hmm. I did kind of like Neil Patrick Harris's comment after Laura Poitras, the filmmaker of Citizen Four. It's a film about Edward Snowden, and they cut back to Neil Patrick Harris in the audience, and he says, well, Edward Snowden couldn't be here for some treason.
some people were offended by that, actually.
I wondered about that. I wondered what the feeling was, because some people do feel it was treasonous. Others feel the exact opposite, that he's a hero. I thought, well, that was a risky one.
But again, Julianne Moore took the chance to talk about Alzheimer's. There were two movies that won that had back to back of the doc and the short that were both about crisis hotlines. There was a lot of humanity on display last night.
Now, one thing I noticed was that there was very little thanking of agents and lots of lists of names. It seemed like they had been coached, don't get up there and give me a list of everybody you've ever met. Get up there.
They're always told that.
They are. They have the same speech every year at the nominations luncheon where they say, don't do that and don't take up a piece of paper. And you've got to do it in just a few seconds. They always do that.
But it felt like this year they actually took it to heart a little bit better. I think it's probably because their films had issues on which they felt compelled to talk.
Exactly.
Well, and I guess, let me ask you this, and you were also the day earlier, because, it's not enough that you have to go to the Oscars on Sunday evening just to prep for it and kind of like a dress rehearsal. You decided, maybe I'll go to the Independent Spirit Awards, too, just to see what happens. So how was that show this year as compared to years past?
That's actually one of the better ones that they've done, and it was very SNL. And Fred Armisen and Kristen Bell are real pros, and their Birdman takeoff was actually better than the one on the Oscars. It was a short film that they did in advance, and it was really funny. They did the same idea, the Birdman takeoff, but it had, Bill Hader was in it, playing Ina Ritu, and it was just hysterical. Did you actually watch the show? They had it live this year.
Only part of it, because it's in the middle of the day.
True. Now it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure it will run again and again on what is it? IFC?
I think it's AMC, AMC. Or TNT or something. Yeah. It turns out it split though. They did the Birdman Best Picture, but they gave Linklater director. And so I thought that might happen at the Oscars, but they went with Birdman for both.
How did your ballot do, Anne? I did 16
very
of 20.
I messed up the shorts, I messed up editing. I thought maybe Birdman would get editing instead of Whiplash. My mistakes were not utter embarrassments exactly. It's just that they added up for, you know, if you followed my ballot completely, you probably didn't do that well in your Oscar pool.
Well, Grand Budapest Hotel, as you had predicted, would win a lot of the Craft Awards, and it did. And winning for best, was it best adapted screenplay?
That was Imitation Game.
Was Graham Moore. Now, did you predict that?
I did, actually. I did. And I thought it would get that one. I mean, it's so interesting. It was nominated for 8 Academy Awards. And I believe that the Weinstein Co. sort of mishandled that campaign.
Oh, yeah.
They just kept going. They were flogging the great man, you know, the poor Alan Turing, the history and everything. And somehow they hit it wrong.
Now
they did for the Oscars, but, you know, they got the movie to $85 million in North America. So maybe that's really,
you know what?
They kept it in the news
all the way to the bank, and it did even better overseas. So, you know, they're in good shape.
Let me ask you something, actually, about that, because you mentioned the Weinsteins and the campaigns. It really does seem, much like Eddie Redmayne had to work the room at all of these events, night after night, week after week, that the campaigning does matter. And we always knew that. But looking at Boyhood, a film that you think is a shoo-in for Best Picture, I mean, who's ever going to try and repeat that type of film? Maybe they will one day. I don't know. But IFC released this movie. This is a small distributor. Among independent distributors, it's an underdog. And doesn't have a lot of experience with Oscar campaigning and awards campaigning, and tried to find a buyer after Sundance in 2014 for that very reason.
Well, they could have had Sony Pictures Classics if they'd been willing to sell it for a smaller amount. That's the thing. I mean, it ended up being more efficacious for them to release it themselves, since they had invested so much in it over the years. I would say that they did an impeccable job, an extraordinary job. Cynthia Schwartz is their Oscar guru, and she did a great job. But it is difficult to match the institutional knowledge that Fox Searchlight has over all these years. I mean, they've had 12 Best Picture nominees in 11 years, and they have done all those campaigns, and they know what they're doing, and they have the money to spend, and they know exactly what to do. And they were running 3 movies this time. They had Wild and Budapest and Birdman, and they came out winning 8 Oscars. So that's pretty intense.
Is there any sense from Budapest or Wild that they felt less love? You know, were they happy with their campaigns?
They were over the moon happy. And I don't think they missed a trick, you know, whereas you could argue that Harvey could have, you know, pulled it out with Imitation Game, because it really was a very popular movie. But something about the way Benedict Cumberbatch didn't do the Eddie Redmayne as well, or whatever it was, it just ended up being something. It won one Oscar, but it was something of an also-ran.
And Eddie Redmayne getting up on stage, I mean, and that moment there where he looks at the Oscar and just goes, wow. And I thought, well, congratulations. That moment will be played over and over.
There's already GIFs all over the place. It's incredible.
Yeah. It's and I'm again, I'm really glad Michael Keaton got up on stage to accept best picture and got a chance to say, and I guess he was talking there and he realized, what the hell am I saying? You know, nobody cares what I think. I'm just happy to be here. And he said what everybody was probably thinking, which is he's probably just, you know, happy to be here. And he said it, and it was just a perfect ending.
Well, I'm not glad, because I wish Boyhood had won. But anyway, I don't think it's too soon, Ann, for you to make predictions for 2016. You're not going to have to go out on a limb here. Just answer this question. Will Star Wars or Avengers Age of Ultron, or the new James Bond film Spectre, or the final Hunger Games movie be nominated for Best Picture?
No.
No, but, nope. but what do you really think, Anne? Don't hold back. Don't hold back.
But will Steven Spielberg's St. James Place, a Cold War epic drama starring Tom Hanks?
There you go.
Front runner.
Absolutely. Or if Martin Scorsese's Silence is done in time. You know, that could be another one.
You know, I read somewhere that Steven Spielberg has been thanked at the Academy Awards more than God.
Oh, there's also The Revenant. Inarritu himself could be back.
Oh, no, there's no. My predictions for 2016 are Black Mass, which is Benedict Cumberbatch and the crime drama about Whitey Bulger. Brooklyn, which was at Sundance, based on a terrific novel. Far From the Madding Crowd. In the Heart of the Sea, the Ron Howard seafaring epic. which is based on the events that inspired Moby Dick.
That looks really good to me. I agree with you. I'm not so sure about Far From the Madding Crowd. That could be a kind of a humming the sets tech thing. We'll see.
Then there's Joy, the David O. Russell film with Jennifer Lawrence, The Revenant, which is a great novel starring Matt Damon and directed by Iñárritu.
And Ron Tom Hardy.
St. James Place, and then The Walk, Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing Wire Walker Philippe Petit.
Cannot wait for that. That's Bob Zemeckis. Fantastic.
I mean, Robert Zemeckis, I beg your pardon. Yeah.
So wait a second. Ron Howard has two films in the next year?
No. It's Steven Spielberg. Okay. Is St. James Place.
Okay. Well, then maybe people can, you know, he can kind of try and get a little bit more of a lead on God. I don't know.
On that note.
Thank you very much, Anne Thompson from IndieWire and from, of course, Thompson on Hollywood. We'll place links to all of your work in the show notes, as well as links to Twitter. AK Stanwyck is her username on Twitter. Anne, it's always a pleasure to talk with you the day after the Oscars. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was nice of Anne to join us. Though, no, I wasn't happy Michael Keaton was on stage. I didn't want the movie to win. I hated Birdman. Hated it.
Well, I know you hated it, but for him...
I hated it.
Oh, you Michael Keaton hater.
I'm not a Michael Keaton fan or a Michael Keaton hater.
I like you, wanted to see Boyhood win. Between those two.
I actually would have preferred an upset by Grand Budapest Hotel.
That would have been amazing. I would have been over the moon at that. But I thought, oh my God, maybe this might happen. This could happen, like, because it kept winning.
After that early, there was one unexpected win. I mean, we thought production design and costumes and makeup, but then there was another win, and you thought, ooh, and then it won score. And I was like, ooh, maybe, but no.
Yeah, and then it went exactly the way we all kind of thought it might. Although, you know, and we didn't get into this with Anne, the way Best Picture is chosen now, you pick, you know, a number one and a number two and a number three, and because of that weighted voting, it could kind of throw the balance off a bit, and you could have a surprise winner in the end, which I think is just silly, but it's so hard to explain that it's not even worth getting into.
It's not hard to explain. People use it in elections all around the country and around the world.
That's stacked ranking.
It just means that, you know, some minor person who gets 80% of the vote, but most of the people don't like, doesn't end up winning.
Right.
You know, to make sure that some, you know, person with a strong but minor backing doesn't end up winning because the vote is split among so many other people. You want to have somebody that most people are comfortable with. Maybe you end up with that broad middle thing like the King's Speech, but you avoid something that most people hate.
Yeah, which unfortunately for you, that did not happen.
Yeah, that's right. So we did list our Oscar nominees for 2016. They're in the show notes. Come back next year, see how well we did.
Well, I'll tell you, if every single one of those films is, that would actually be big news to me.
Well, they wouldn't all be, because there's certainly some indie films or some art films that I haven't known about, or a foreign film. Maybe one of the Pixar films, like the one about the little girl inside her brain, you know, that could become the one that could finally win them over and get them to make another Best Picture nominee for animated film. But like you said, the era of big blockbuster entertainments getting Oscar nominations just doesn't happening. Even though they've expanded the Oscars, you're not seeing Guardians of the Galaxy. You're not seeing Star Trek. You're not seeing Interstellar. They're just not making the cut.
Yeah, I'll tell you. What is the? I think it's Inside Out is the name.
Inside Out. That's right. Which the trailer was great.
If it's 50% as good as the kind of sample footage that was shown at CinemaCon and Cine Europe and all of these trade shows that they keep showing up at, and Disney keeps showing these clips from it that are unbelievable. If it's half as good as that, this movie is going to be a huge hit.
Well, I'm sure it'll be a huge hit. Almost every Pixar film is.
That's right.
They're always a big deal.
Ah, well, if a Pixar film is a big deal, let me ask you this, Michael. Are some of the stories I'm about to mention to you a big deal or possibly a big whoop? Because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Now, before we get to our first story, I just want to remind our listeners once again, Lady Gaga will be here later on.
Apparently, you're going to play something at the end. Okay.
No, I'm not, actually. That's the whole point. I'm not going to play anything. I'm just going to keep teasing it incessantly for 3 hours and then finally kind of have something in any case. Filming of the new Mission Impossible movie, Michael, has proven, what's the word I'm looking for? Impossible, actually. That's a good word for it. The Tom Cruise action franchise shut down production on Mission Impossible 5 while the screenwriters huddled over a new ending. Director Christopher McQuarrie is working with a super secret writing friend for a week or two. Gee, I wonder who it could be.
Who is it?
Bryan Singer.
How do you know?
Well, they're good friends.
Oh, maybe Bryan Singer's busy, but anyway, okay.
That's true. Not that the original ending of the script, Michael, wasn't great, of course. A studio source insists that the ending was in a quote-unquote good place, and now they're trying to get it to a quote-unquote more perfect place, whatever that means. But will the new script pages, this is what I want to know, will they self-destruct in 5 seconds? Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, of course.
Well, I put this story in, and I think you highlighted it as well, just because I know you love it when they start a movie and don't have a script.
Yeah. Well, they had a script. They just weren't happy with the ending. And at some point they said, yeah, the ending sucks. That's kind of amazing. That's pretty incompetent. That's ridiculous. However, we all know a million examples of movies that had beautifully run productions and turned out to be turkeys, and other movies that were incredibly troubled and turned out to be great. So it's not really telling, but when you have to shut down your movie for a week or two, you've done something wrong.
Sports! The major networks love sports. It's a live event, guys watch them, so what's not to like? That's why CBS is bringing boxing back to prime time after 15 years. Boxing was once a top 10 weekly event on TV in the 1950s, but of course has long faded from popularity thanks to endless corruption, rigged matches, and so many different governing bodies that declaring a world champion is almost impossible. And Michael gets very annoyed that the major networks ignore Saturday night prime time. Why concede such valuable real estate, he wants to know, so he'll be glad to hear that's exactly where CBS is airing the matches. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big, I don't know. Is it a big deal? I mean, it's not a big deal, but, you know, thank God they are programming on Saturday night. I saw the headline, CBS bringing back boxing, and I thought, Saturday night. And you turn to their story, and yep, Saturday night. So at least they're, you know, putting something on. They've had NASCAR on there, the networks. They've got boxing now. They've got college sports. It just, you know, why leave the lights off on one night of the week when you've got, you know, people who are still there? And frankly, with DVRs, doesn't matter, you know, show a show at 4 a.m, you should be able to get an audience. But, you know.
Well, maybe so, if the lights are, maybe they're just trying to conserve energy, leaving the lights off.
Maybe, but so. Yeah. And, you know, boxing used to be huge, of course, you know. And so there's no, you know, in boxing, I don't think it's ever going to come back the way it was. Of course it won't. But still, it has a big audience. It reaches Latinos, a strong Latino audience, a strong Black audience. So people who watch a lot of TV and love boxing, you can bring them back to your network.
Well, one of the incidents that kind of helped, I don't want to say helped, but caused boxing to be taken from the air was in 1962. It was a fight between Benny Kid Parrott versus Emile Griffith. And it was a fight that went 12 rounds, and in the end, Griffith hit Parrott like 29 times in a row and 18 times in 6 seconds, and it put Parrott in a coma, and he died, I guess, 10 days later. This was the subject of a documentary called Ring of Fire in 2005 that was quite touching and quite moving, but because of that incident, the networks decided we should not be airing this in prime time anymore.
Really?
Yeah, that's what the documentary kind of went on to show.
I saw an interview with the director. I don't quite remember that being the death knell of primetime boxing. I thought it was already sort of out on its way, but it was an interesting film. You know, Parrott had taunted Griffith as being gay, which turns out he was, and he taunted him as being gay when they were doing their weigh-in, and that was sort of one of the things that triggered the fight and the viciousness of the fight. And so, you know, it was him coming to terms with who he was and coming to terms with what he'd done and what his responsibility was or not was, since it was refereed. So it was an interesting film, but I mean, you know, baseball used to be on in prime time. It's not anymore. Football is now in prime. I think it's just that boxing went the way of other sports. I don't know if it became too ugly and violent because we're watching football.
Yeah, that's true. Although in football, everybody's wearing helmets, so most of the time you don't see the violence close up the way you do in boxing.
True.
Now, Michael, are you still laughing at the kids from Twilight?
I am.
Well, no, we haven't heard much from Taylor Lautner lately, admittedly, but Robert Pattinson has finally made some acclaimed films while working with directors like Werner Herzog and David Cronenberg, and Kristen Stewart just became the first American woman to win France's César Award for Best Actress. She did it with her role of personal assistant to Juliette Binoche in the drama Clouds of Sils Maria. Adrian Brody, by the way, won the Best Actor César for The Pianist. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal for Kristen Stewart.
That's true.
You know, doesn't make any difference for her Hollywood career, but good for her, you know?
You know what she said? I should have paid more attention in French class.
Yeah, she was acting in English, of course, I believe.
Yes, exactly.
Did you see the film? It was at Cannes.
I did not, actually.
Ah. Oh, well. Maybe I did,
and I don't remember it.
Well, I like Juliette Binoche, so for that reason alone, I would want to watch it.
Maybe I did see this. I can't remember. That's how many films I've seen.
It's one of the two films that sort of played off. There was a Cronenberg film set in Hollywood as well with acting, and so they were both sort of linked together a lot of times, talking about actors and competitiveness and performance in the industry.
Right. And that's why I think I got them confused. And I did see the Cronenberg film, which Julianne Moore was in, Maps to the Stars.
Which comes out in like March, but it's basically getting like a limited release with video on demand at the same time. Trying, of course, to capitalize on her Oscar win.
Right. And I would say when I saw that movie, I thought, oh, this will be the film that helps Juliet win an Academy Award. I was wrong, but she did win an Academy Award. It was another film. Julianne Moore.
Yep.
Yeah, best actress. Actor Richard Dreyfuss is going to play Ponzi scheme mastermind Bernie Madoff in an event for CBS. But the amusing news is how this bit of programming has been described. CBS called it a quote-unquote multiple episode drama. A drama and a close-ended drama or close-ended drama. Is there some reason they're reluctant to say the word mini-series? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, but I couldn't understand why they were jumping through hoops. It's a close-ended. It's a drama that stops. It's a drama. How do we say this? It's a drama. It's like, for God's sakes, it's called a miniseries. What is wrong with you people? But maybe it's an Emmy thing, or I don't know. They think it's less classy to be a miniseries. I don't know. They haven't really done miniseries in a long time. I don't know what their problem was, but it was kind of hilarious to see themselves twist themselves into knots, trying not to say miniseries.
Well, and maybe this is the reason why. The Emmys made a host of changes to their rules. First and foremost, a comedy is defined as any half-hour show. A drama is defined as a one-hour show. If you insist your hour-long show is a comedy, you have to petition a new 9-person panel appointed by the Academy and get 2/3 of them to agree with you. Since so many more shows are produced, the nominees for comedy and drama will be 7 shows each instead of 6. A show is either a series or a limited series. If you don't have a recurring characters and storylines, if it's a story with a beginning, middle, and end, then you're a limited series. If you do have those elements, you're a series. If you act in 50% or more of a show's episodes, you're not a guest actor.
So I'm not a special guest star on Showbiz Sandbox?
No, you're not. You are a lead actor.
All right.
Talk shows and sketch comedy shows now get their own categories.
Thank God.
There is no expansion of acting nominees so far. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I hope that wasn't too much at the time. It's all very straightforward. It's all very sensible. And they have a new panel to decide rather than letting people submit it to whatever they want. Every change they made is illogical to me. Maybe there's something I'm not thinking of, but, you know, well done. Long overdue, but at least they seem to have gotten it righter.
Writer.
I mean, for God's sake.
More correct, you mean?
Comparing Saturday Night Live or Key and Peele to the David Letterman show just makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, they're just completely different types of shows. So it's so annoying that they were in the same category all these years. So thank God they split that up. And again, the Bernie Madoff thing, it's a limited series. You know,
yes.
If you don't want to use, you know, they've said it begins and it ends. Don't worry about it.
Starbucks is going to stop selling CDs in its stores, to which some people might immediately say, you mean Starbucks was still selling CDs? In fact, the coffee chain had one of the biggest footprints in the country for music sales. They only carried a handful of titles at any one time, but Starbucks was so influential that at one point they had a record label, Hear Music, and were signing legacy artists to deals. Their push helped power sales for some rising talent and classic acts like Madeline Peyrou and Ray Charles, along with recent albums like Taylor Swift's 1989 and the Frozen soundtrack. Now, there's one less place people can spot a new CD and make an impulse buy. Actually, you know what? Make that 21,000 fewer places. Big deal or big whoop?
And that's only in North America. It's probably a big whoop, but, you know, no, I think it's a big deal. I mean, there's so few places left where you can actually go buy a physical CD. They didn't have much, but at least it was one. And now it's gone. I've actually looked at their CDs and occasionally bought one because you can't walk into a store anymore.
Yeah.
Very frustrating.
And, you know, the Decemberists' most recent album came out, and I said, oh, the Decemberists, so, I mean, you know, I'll take an Americano, and this is $12.95. Are you kidding me?
That's not a lot for a CD.
Well, these days you can go buy the whole album on iTunes for like $9.99. Why would you pay $12?
Well, that's $10 to $12. That's not that much of a difference.
Okay, well, $13 if you count the 12.
Well, that, and that's why your devaluing of the artist has meant CD sales have collapsed.
Are you trying to say I'm responsible for digital dimes?
If you look on Amazon.com, it's $12.
Oh, okay.
$11.88 for the CD, $11.49 for the MP3.
Okay.
All right.
All right, I'm wrong. Now, apparently, the AMC series Mad Men is coming to an end.
What?
Yeah, apparently we haven't heard that enough. But a recent press release discussed this as if it were the Beatles breaking up or the death of Picasso. Not to worry, they said. The end of this iconic series would be commemorated with a gold coin. It's going to be commemorated at cultural institutions around the country. Now Don Draper's gray suit and fedora is going to the Smithsonian, and that makes sense. But that's just the start, with events and screenings and showcasing of the show taking place in New York City at the Museum of the Moving Image, at the LA County Museum of Art, Lincoln Center, the Museum of Jewish Heritage. Why that? Don't get me started on why that's happening. The New York Public Library and the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
I think there are Jewish characters in the show.
I know. I think maybe they're playing My House too, just for fun. Big Dealer, Big Whoop.
Big Whoop, of course. And, it's not so bad because it's basically New York.
Yes.
Across the country. And I was like, what? But no, there's nothing
by
in St.
country,
Louis.
We mean Manhattan.
Yeah, Manhattan. Well, and Brooklyn. Yeah, so it's like, okay, it's a New York set series, blah, 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 whatever. Okay. So, Smithsonian makes sense. All the rest is just a bunch of hoopla.
Yeah, okay. So I guess then you're right. It's not a big deal. But you know what is going to be a big deal? Now that the Academy Awards are over.
What's that?
The Tonys.
Oh, you're trying to segue. I'm like, huh? Well, no, the Tonys aren't for... Well, the Tonys are what? Yeah, I guess they're like 3 months away.
Yes. And now, before we get to this segment, I would like to remind everybody that Lady Gaga will be performing a special medley at some point during our show. But in the interim, I will just continue to tease it. But it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, I guess now the Academy Awards are over, as I just mentioned. Everybody's kind of looking, well, what's the next big award show? The American Music Awards or those Tonys? And they're saying, well, what could possibly be honored at the Tonys this year? And then they look and go, wow, there's a lot of musicals coming up.
That's right. The Tony Awards take place on June 7th. And I don't know who's the host. Maybe Neil Patrick Harris. He seems to be available. But there are a lot of new musicals, which is kind of unusual. There's 11 new musicals that have opened up in the spring in this second half of the season, which is a lot. And, the question is, why? Why are there so many new musicals coming out?
Yeah, I don't know. You tell me, because I'm so far away from them. I just saw Wicked again for the umpteenth time. Took my kids to see Wicked. I was surprised. People were on their feet raving and clapping as if they'd never seen it before. And then I realized, they haven't, actually. They had not seen it before. And it got, standing ovations. People were, the song would come to an end and they jumped to their feet.
People love that musical.
I know.
And Billy Elliot, you just saw that recently with your family.
That's true, yes.
And those are all new musicals. The last time Broadway had a hit revival, you could maybe put Cabaret, the newest edition of Cabaret, but the last time they revived a show and had a big hit with it, making it one of the biggest hits of all time, was 42nd Street back in 2001. Chicago is still on the boards. That's an even bigger hit. That's one of the top three biggest running shows of all time. That launched a long time ago, though. So the last time they revived a show and had a big hit with it was back in 2001. That's 14 years ago, and that's the musical 42nd Street. Since then, they've got a lot of shows that actually clicked, and of course, right up there is the Book of Mormon, one of the biggest hits, going, and Kinky Boots and Once and Newsies and Rock of Ages. You just go back and there's 20, 30 shows that have become big hits since 42nd Street was a big hit revival. So that's where the money is right now. Revivals.
Not to interrupt you, but as a little way to tie in the Academy Awards to this story, that it needs to be. 42nd Street, do you know the theater in which 42nd Street opened?
The revival played in the theater where Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark played. It's the biggest space on Broadway right now. But I don't know where the original played.
The original was in the St. James Theater. I believe it's on 44th Street. That is the same theater that Birdman was shot in.
Oh, really?
Yes. Not that amounts to a hill of beans for this story, but still.
Is that another Broadway reference? Is that what you're doing there?
Hill of Beans? No.
The So, new musicals are where the money's at, unless, of course, you let a film shoot in your theater space while it's empty. And so that's where people are making new musicals. So we've got a string of them coming out, and we'll run through them and tell you which ones are worth your time.
Okay, so let's start with maybe Something Rotten! Exclamation point.
Exclamation point. That's right. Why another, you know, there's money to be made, but there's also a Tony to be won. And that's the best way to position your show to become a hit musical is to win the Tony for Best Musical. That's the one award that matters. And this year, up until a few weeks ago, it felt like it was wide open race. No show had opened in the fall and said, my God, we're going to be the big Tony winner. It hadn't happened. It certainly wasn't The Last Ship, the Sting musical. It wasn't Honeymoon in Vegas. Everybody felt like it was there to be grabbed. Somebody needed to take a show and do it. So here you've got Something Rotten. It's a musical comedy, just like Book of Mormon. It stars Brian D'Arcy James and Christian Borley, who's in Smash and was in Peter and the Starcatcher. And it's about the competitors of Shakespeare who invent the musical. It's a hilarious romp set in, you know, the 1500s. So it's total silliness. It's total fun. And they showcased it for backers and investors. And everybody said, we love it. It was such a success. They said, why go out of town? The show was supposed to go out of town, play, you fix it, you work on it, and then you bring it back like in the fall or next spring. And they said, no, we love it. It's perfect. Go to Broadway. And so they are skipping the out of town and opening cold on Broadway, which doesn't happen a lot, but it does. And the reason is, there's money to be made. They thought the Tony was up for grabs.
Now, what about The Visit with Cheetah Rivera, the legendary Cheetah Rivera?
That's right. It's probably the last show you'll ever see where Cheetah Rivera is starring in a new musical. It's the Candor and Ebb show. They've been futzing it with her for years. It played out of town with Angela Lansbury. It played out of town with Cheetah Rivera. They never quite figured it out. Now they're finally bringing it to Broadway. If you want to see her, great. If not, I don't necessarily think they've probably solved the puzzle of the show. It's a good showcase for Cheetah Rivera. But other than that, I'd be surprised if it turned out to be a great work.
I think the puzzle was, hey, cast Cheetah Rivera. People will show up. Amazing.
That's right.
And what about Hamilton? This is the new musical from Lin-Manuel Miranda from In the Heights.
That's right. And this is the thing that has spoiled everybody's plans. They all thought the Tony was up for grabs, but not anymore because Hamilton is coming to Broadway. They haven't announced yet. At least I haven't checked my email in the last few minutes. But everyone expects Hamilton to transfer from the public and go right to Broadway so they can make the Tony deadline. This is a rap musical based on the early days of our nation's founding. It's about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr and their rivalry and their friendship. Massive rave reviews. Everybody loved it. I think it needs work, but I think it's a lot of fun. I would go see it again happily. This baby is now the front runner for Broadway, which is a bummer for Fun Home, which was the other musical coming from the public that was transferring to Broadway and hoped to be the critic darling that would have the cool vote. Now that cool vote is going to Hamilton, and that looks like the big hit to beat.
Now, I saw Lin-Manuel Miranda perform in the Heights, actually.
Oh, you
back.
Did? I did not. Was it fun?
Yes. Yes. It was, you know, it had just won the Tony for best musical, and or was on its way to winning the Tony, actually, I should say. It was kind of like this out-of-nowhere hit, and people loved it. Got a standing ovation, although, you know, so does, you know, the opening of an envelope on Broadway these days. Anyway.
Well, when it doesn't get a standing ovation, I saw Honeymoon in Vegas, and the audience was kind. They were tourists, and they were happy to see Tony Danza. Was not a good show. I didn't like it when it opened in Jersey, but opened on Broadway, and the audience did not give a standing ovation. You're talking like a few days after it opened, then you know you're in trouble, because they give a standing ovation to everything. They were not rude. They were clapping. They were happy. They were nice. Some people stood, but it was not the pro forma standing ovation, and that's when you know, oh God, uh-oh, there goes our $10 million.
Well, you must think that the same thing will happen to Gigi.
That's right. There's a couple of shows based on movie musicals or movie properties. There's Gigi, there's Dr. Zhivago, there is Finding Neverland, which is based on a drama, there is An American in Paris. All those are new musicals that are coming to Broadway for the first time. I never liked Gigi. Dr. Zhivago, I think, is opening cold, so we have no sense of what it is, and I just can't imagine it being good. And Finding Neverland is a little bit of trouble. You know, they dumped Jeremy Jordan, and they brought in Matthew Morrison of Glee. It also stars Kelsey Grammer. It got polite reviews in Chicago, but we don't know if they've ever actually figured it out, and the poster is ugly. And finally, there's An American in Paris. This opened in Paris, which seems to make sense, right? Except Paris never hosts musicals. Broadway shows never play there. They're disdainful of Broadway shows. And this one did, and it got good reviews, and it's very dance-centered. And it's not quite the movie, which I'm not a big fan of either, even though it's a classic Hollywood musical. And it got good reviews, but you got to remember, this is out of town, and this isn't like the New York Times sent a big critic to review it. You're talking about stringers and people who are not usually reviewing big shows about to go to Broadway. And sometimes when you open in Chicago or you open in Paris or what else, they're so excited to see a big show that they're like, oh my God, it's really good. So you can't quite trust the reviews. So it has good buzz. I'm not sure about it. But of all that batch of shows based on movies and classic properties, that's the one I'm most interested in.
I'm most interested to see how they get a stick figure and cast a stick figure in Diary of a Wimpy Kid, the musical, because it's going to be premiering in Minneapolis.
Well, it's children's theater. It's part of the season of children's theater. So it's probably a show that is not having its eye on Broadway. It's hoping for high school and regional productions and things like that. Though, of course, if it turned out to be brilliant, anything can happen. But it's got music and lyrics by Joe Iconis and a book by Joe Trace, T-R-A-C-Z. I'm not sure how to say his name.
Trace.
Okay. But they've, it's a huge property. 120 million copies are sold of Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Okay. It's not 50 Shades of Grey numbers, but it is a big property. And so if they can develop a show that appeals to kids and is easy to put on, that could have a big life and be very profitable once they tour with it. And then kids start mounting it in grade schools and high schools all over the country.
Now, you know what I think is a big, big deal or a big star is Kelly O'Hara. I love her.
Well, she's great, and she is starring in a revival of The King and I with Ken Watanabe. And, you know, if you're looking for revivals that can be big hits, you know, South Pacific was a very big hit. It didn't break into the top 100 of all time, so I didn't count it. But, you know, it did quite well, and this is from Lincoln Center, the same people. It'll be big. It'll
starring Kelly O'Hara, who also starred in South Pacific.
Right, starring Kelly O'Hara. So it will be big, it'll be classy, it'll be fun. It's a good, not great Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, but it'll be solid, safe entertainment. So if you want to place your money down on a show and you want to be sure to have a decent time, you at least know The King and I and On the 20th Century, which is another revival. That's a Comden and Green show with Christian Chenoweth and Peter Gallagher. Either one of those is probably the safest bet of all.
So you picked next year's Oscar nominees for Best Picture. Are you picking any of these for Best Musical?
Well, Hamilton will win Best Musical if it gets to Broadway, you know, in time. They haven't quite announced it yet. And I think perhaps The King and I will win Best Revival.
Okay. Well, you know, I can almost guarantee that some of the people we're about to talk about won't be nominated for Tonys, not only because they don't work on Broadway, but because they're no longer working.
Well, because that's the worst segue to the obituaries I've ever heard.
Well, I don't know how to segue to obituaries. I don't know how to tell you that every week.
That ends, you know, inside baseball. Let's move on to obituaries and some sad news. Of course, it always seems more tragic when somebody dies unexpectedly, and certainly of a drug overdose, which is the possibility here. Harris Whittles was a co-executive producer and writer on Parks and Recreation. He died very unexpectedly. He was 30 years old. Apparently, he had been fighting drug addiction for years. Very sad news, obviously.
Yes, and Clark Terry, the jazz trumpeter, he died at the age of 94. He is
not so sad.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's
you
sad.
You know, he's had a great life.
Yeah, he toured with Duke Ellington and Count Basie. He's played with Thelonious Monk and Charles Mingus. You know, obviously, as a trumpet player myself, hugely influential.
Do you play the trumpet?
Well, I used to, but you know, it's not a very forgiving instrument. So you don't just pick it up again and start from where you left off. You pretty much have to work your way back to where you were, and usually you never get there.
And he broke down some barriers. He was the first black musician to be in NBC's core of musicians that they had on staff, sort of. And he would be on The Tonight Show. He was on The Tonight Show for many years, which I didn't really know this, but I guess it was in the 60s and 70s or whatever. But when they did Stump the Band, he was always really good at sort of, if they didn't know it, he would sort of fake and improvise a goofy version of what maybe the song was, because he had a great sense of humor, but a very smart guy, very passionate about jazz education, and a real loss.
Also a real loss is Bruce Sanofsky. He is the Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker. He died at the age of 58 some complications with diabetes. It's probably best known for the Paradise Lost trilogy, and this is the documentaries they played in theaters, but also aired on HBO of the West Memphis Three, the three teenagers that were convicted of killing and mutilating a young boy, or was it more than I can't remember whether it was more than one boy now.
Well, I mean, there's nothing like advocacy journalism to actually, you know, change justice and shine a light on some injustice and right a wrong. And that's what they did with these projects, these films. So that's kind of amazing. But they also did Brothers Keeper, which is a terrific movie, and Metallica.
Yeah, Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, was documentary on Metallica. I actually wound up helping promote Brothers Keeper by going around with flyers. I was in film school at the time, and his producer was a teacher at the film school. And they said, oh, let's go help out this filmmaker, Bruce Sanofsky and Joe Berlinger, hand out flyers to the movie. And we did.
Did you get to see the film?
Yes, it's an interesting...
No. I mean, like, did they say, okay, you put out flyers, we'll show you the film, or did you just have to pay for it?
No, I went to pay for it. It's a documentary film. They needed all the help they could get.
And finally, let's remember Joan Rivers, because the Oscars didn't.
Well, does she have any...
She's on the red carpet every year.
Okay,
my first thought was, well, she's not really a Hollywood movie person, but
right.
I forget because I don't watch the red carpet show. She was on the red carpet for ages. She was an iconic member of the Oscars, and while they never sort of acknowledged her or wanted to, I mean, she redefined coverage of the Oscars as far as people doing red carpet and how obsessed they were about the clothing and commenting on it, and that became a big part of the show, so, you know. And she certainly did direct a film, one of the few women, you know, even today, that's directed a major feature film. And she did a flop comedy, Rabbit Test, with Billy Crystal.
True. Good point. And, you know, I guess if you're honoring Maya Angelou as an actor.
Who also directed.
Yes, that's true.
In television. I don't know if she ever directed a feature film, but yes, exactly. You know.
Well,
why not?
And there may be a reason that she was left out. Maybe she wanted to be.
There was no reason. There was just stupidity. I mean, the Grammys left off some topic. They left off Jimmy Scott. Like, what the heck? And you had that long... First of all, you should not have the In Memoriam without clips. Secondly, you should not do the In Memoriam and then follow it up with a five-minute song. I don't care. I don't want to hear a song performed. We just saw the In Memoriam. Why are we now spending another... It's not a Grammy show. We're not here for songs. We are here for the movies. And at the very least, if they're going to have Jennifer Hudson, they could have scrolled every damn name in the world while she was singing so that you didn't miss anybody. Because you always have to choose. You can't include everybody. There's too many people involved in movies around the world. You're always going to miss people or run out of time. But if you're going to have 10 minutes devoted to it, why not scroll all their names? I don't get it.
Well, I certainly the New York Times actually compared it to the movie Grammys.
The movie
telecast,
Grammys?
Yes. The Oscar telecast it's not the movies, it's the Grammys. It's not the Oscars. They said there were so many musical performances that it was more like the Grammys.
Something Rotten is playing at the St. James Theater.
Okay.
I was wondering what was going to step into that empty theater, and it's Something Rotten, one of the big musical comedies of the spring.
Okay. See earlier in the show for speaking of the show, oh my goodness, we're out of time. I'd like to apologize to Lady Gaga, whose musical performance we will not be able to get to on this show. But if you have any complaints about that or any feedback for us, please do write to us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, or mobile podcast app. Please do rate and review the show. It does help us out. All of that information, as well as ways to follow us on Twitter, we're at Showbiz Sandbox. On Facebook, it's facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Links to all the stories that we discussed on today's episode can be found on showbizsandbox.com. That's also where we are going to place links to the work of Ann Thompson over at IndieWire. I'd like to thank her for joining us to discuss the Oscars. All of that information, again, is going to be on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, you have a website. Every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week?
ButterLampWasRobbed.com.
Butterlamp was robbed?
Yes, the live-action short film. Ridiculous. I cannot believe that the phone call won. A piece of junk, and the Butterlamp was actually great. It was the only category I cared about, and the Oscars made me angry yet again.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing about the entertainment industry and coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not try michaelgiltz.com, head on over to the Huffington Post, or try bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.